What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Lights Out. This is a very disturbing case for sure. But in 2006, a group of teenagers created a sect of Satanism out of rebellion. And this group was first started by Konstantin Baranov with his old friend Nikolai Bogolobiak.
They felt like they needed to take it a step further and start performing sacrificial rituals. The rumors began to spread about this group. One told the story of members digging up a body of a recently deceased girl. The rumors said that they ate her heart.
Allegedly, he wrote the notes in a book that was bound in the skin of the victims, as well as removing their hearts and the tongues before cooking them and eating them.
And he was released as a free man.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Lights Out. I'm Josh, and I'm joined in the studio by my best friends.
Oh, man. Wow.
That's what you guys are today. I mean, you guys are my best friends, but
he said today.
Today.
Like just tomorrow.
But Austin and Danny are here. What's up, guys?
Hey, man.
Bit of a cold spell here in Colorado. I mean, it's cold in the winter in Colorado, obviously, but it's like below zero.
Yeah. Today. And given the setting of our script today, you know, it's this episode, Rush has blown into Denver here.
Seems like it, man. It's bitter cold out there.
Yeah.
And I'm not normally cold at all. Like I sleep in practically below freezing. Like even right now, I turned our heat off last night.
Really? Bold move.
And it dropped to like 58 or something. And in the middle of the night, Kendall wakes me up and she's like, Josh, it's too cold. Go turn on the heat. So I went and turned it back on because I don't know. I get my best sleep when I'm like...
Same. They say it's actually good to sleep in cold temps. So I love when it's cold. I mean, if I could, I have roommates, so I have to keep it a little bit higher because they're kind of babies about it. But sorry, Johnny and Sam. but I would keep it at like 50, 55 if I could during the night.
That's like perfect. It's like, yeah, I want to get into bed and like snuggle up, like feel warm under the covers. Yeah. I don't want to be like, well, it's too hot, I got to take the covers off.
Yeah, agreed. I'm the same way.
But speaking of the cold, we are going to be traveling over to Russia today to talk about a devil worshiping cult and an individual by the name of Nikolai Bogolobiak. And there's obviously going to be a lot of Russian pronunciations in here. And we're, you know, I don't speak Russian. I barely can speak Spanish, well, a few words in Spanish. So we're going to do our very best to pronounce their names and some of the places as best as we can, but we might get it wrong.
Yeah. So we apologize beforehand, blanket apology before this whole thing.
Please don't come for us if our Russian is not very good. But this is a very disturbing case for sure. So just forewarning, I mean, I think everybody here who tunes in weekly on Lights Out kind of knows what to expect at this point.
Yeah.
You know, we get into some pretty gnarly, gruesome stuff here. So this is no different. This is right up there with some of the worst stories that we've covered here on the show. But nevertheless, I think it's one that probably a lot of people haven't heard of. I mean, just researching this particular case was pretty tough, right?
Yeah, well, a lot of it was through Russian publications, which I had to use like some translation browser software to even piece the story together. Some of the translations a little weird, but I got as much as I could, and luckily there was some stories out here on this because I think it's also an important case to get out there, which I think a lot of people don't really know about what's happening currently.
I certainly didn't know much about the Russian criminal justice system and how they deal with heinous killers. I mean,
yeah,
the crimes wild that this group commits is beyond disturbing and disgusting. And it seems like they, you know, despite what their leaders say that, you know, they do when it comes to criminals like this, seems like it's very almost like a slap on the wrist.
Yeah, they're letting everybody go, honestly. It's wild.
It's absolutely insane. And so obviously, for the sake of the victims of this particular case, you know, they still are wanting and in desperate need of justice for what was done to their loved ones, because it is terrifying. So with that being said, buckle up, because here we go. So our story takes place in the city of Yaroslavl. It's about 170 miles northeast of Moscow. The city and the surrounding areas is heavily forested, with long, cold winters and short, warm summers. It's one of Russia's oldest cities, actually. It's founded in 1010. That's, what is that like?
That was like
8,000 years ago. Like, my God, that's a long time ago.
That's so old.
1010.
Yeah, Russia has a pretty deep history. I'm not super familiar with it, but it goes way back. And it's, I always find it interesting that when people were finding places to live, they're like, oh yeah, this terribly densely forested, extremely frigid in the winter place. This is where we're going to set up shop.
I mean, isn't that most of Russia though?
Yeah, a lot of it, especially like Siberia, is basically
just a tundra.
Yeah. Which I know a lot of nomadic tribes still live there and stuff, but it's very hard to
Siberia.
Live there.
Yeah. Siberian stuff. God. But this particular town or city is known for its beautiful church architecture, which they definitely have some very beautiful churches there and cathedrals. I mean, historically, Orthodox Christianity is one of the biggest faiths in the area. But in 2006, a group of teenagers created a sect of Satanism out of rebellion. And this group was first started by Konstantin Baranov. And he had just reconnected with his old friend Nikolai Ogolobiak. Now, Konstantin and Nikolai had met in school and had become friends, and they bonded over their interests in hiking, camping, navigation, and sailing. They both sailed in competitions in Volga and Rybinsk, and Nikolai would even go on to study navigation after high school. He never became a navigator because he had failed the vision tests, because Nikolai is actually partially blind, so he ended up training as a boat foreman instead. Despite the two teenagers sailing together, there were a few years when Nikolai and Konstantin didn't talk. When Nikolai was 17 and Konstantin was 15, they reconnected. Konstantin was always into trying new things. He mentioned his new clan to Nikolai and he joined in. He was introduced to all of Konstantin's other friends, including Alexei Chistakov. Konstantin dove into the Satanist reading material. Now, we don't really know like what this material was.
Unfortunately, not.
So it's really hard to say. I mean, it's probably some, I don't know,
off-brand,
something they found on the internet, most likely, or some random book somewhere. But when they'd all get together, they started mimicking some of the rituals that were in this material they were looking at. But they also spent a lot of their time just hanging out and drinking. Drinking is a big part of what these guys do, and kind of mix that with devil worshiping. You can only imagine where things go.
Yep. So within a year of forming this group, three more members joined the Satanic sect. A hierarchy then began to grow, and Konstantin just took the leader position. Nikolai considered himself a, quote, novice, but we'll see a bit later, he would become the group's enforcer. He hadn't really read into any of this material. He didn't know what the Satanist books were. He just kind of went along with whatever Konstantin said. So he just took his word for it, and they went on. By 2008, reading these books and basically how Nikolai said they were just playing devil worship, it just wasn't enough for the group at that point. They felt like they needed to take it a step further and start performing sacrificial rituals. So they started going around town killing cats, dogs, and rodents during their rituals, which we've kind of seen this before in these niche fringe satanic sects where they start killing neighborhood animals.
Yeah, right? It always seems to start with animal sacrifice.
And, yeah.
I mean, because ultimately they want to bring blood into the picture.
And exactly.
That's the easiest way in their eyes to get it.
So any new members who wanted to join were usually initiated with the blood of the animals by having it smeared on their faces. They began to meet at this vacant lot behind 5th Torfiani Lane, and this lot stood between a private plot of land and an old cemetery. It was also located in the police station district on the south side of town. And here in this lot, the Satanists soon installed an inverted cross in the vacant field, and they would also tie the animal carcasses to this cross Other times, they would light up a bonfire and burn the animal remains in the lot.
But, so where's the police at?
Yeah, I know. Isn't that crazy?
In the district where there's police. I mean, again, I know nothing about how police operate in Russia, but yeah. I would assume it's somewhat similar. Like they at least patrol.
Yeah, I'm not sure. But yeah, they're in the police district just getting drunk and hanging out in this vacant field and killing animals. Yeah. Soon enough, the rumors began to spread about this group, and one told the story of members digging up a body of a recently deceased girl, possibly from that cemetery that was right next door to the vacant lot. And supposedly, the rumor said that they ate her heart.
What? A
crazy rumor.
Oh my God.
And although these rumors at first seem ridiculous, soon enough, we'll see that this is actually pretty close to the truth here.
So it's not out of the realm of possibility that they actually did this.
Yeah.
As disturbing as that is.
Yeah. Meanwhile, kind of on the side, the founder, Constantine, had fallen in love. His girlfriend's name was Ksenia Kovalova. It started with them exchanging love letters that continued long into their relationship, and many of these letters will later be used as evidence in court. But in these, I couldn't find them, but they called each other nicknames and constantly told each other how much they loved one another. In every single letter and every single text message, they said things like, "I'm crying, I miss you, Bunny, my beloved, I love you." So it definitely seems like very youthful love here.
Yeah, seems pretty soft for a bunch of devil worshippers. Yeah, if you ask me. I mean, my God. I think what that shows you, though, is just how young and immature these guys are.
Mm-hmm. The very like early obsessively in love type stuff, like sending letters and constantly texting each other back and forth. Yeah.
I mean, we all did that, I feel like.
Yeah, yep. There's always that time.
We all did cringy things in our youth.
Yeah. I still do that, honestly.
Yeah, I still call my loved one Bunny. I love you, Bunny.
So, the couple was clearly in love at the time. It's believed that Constantine was so in love that he was willing to kill for Ksenia, and he knew her initiation into their Satanist cult. It just had to be special. So, she would soon become the first of the Satanists to be initiated with human blood.
So clearly trying to show off, it seems like.
For my girlfriend, right?
Right, yeah. Right. Oh, we're not going to do animal blood for you. We're going to get human blood. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the future victims were teenage girls about 16 or 17 years old named Olya Pyukova and Anya Gorakova. And they had met one of the members at school through a study group. And soon the two girls were interested in the rest of the Satanists. You know, I can see how they might be intrigued, and you know, if you're kind of on the outside at school and you know you have an opportunity to get in with these guys, you know, you might be like, okay, what's going on with this?
Yeah,
this is definitely weird. But
and you know there's alcohol there, so like
true,
that's the hookup, you know.
In summer of 2008, the Satanists started meeting at Nikolai's apartment. He had the place to himself because his father didn't live with the rest of his family and his mother spent the summers in their country house. Nikolai was 18 at the time, and he had two part-time jobs. He took night classes, and he was dating a girl he planned on marrying. He hoped the money from his jobs would be enough to one day move out of his parents' apartment, but he had a bad habit of blowing his paycheck with his friends. He was always the one buying booze for the Satanist meetings. And one evening, on June 28, 2008, the Satanists stocked up on alcohol and met up at Nikolai's apartment. The Satanists' new friends, Olya and Anya, joined them. According to Nikolai, the girls had called him earlier in the day saying that they would join the party. Nikolai claimed he tried to dissuade them, but they insisted. At the time, the girls considered themselves as part of the goth subculture, but they never had anything to do with the satanic rituals or animal cruelty. Anya wanted to join them because she was romantically interested in one of the members, Alexei. When they were all together at the apartment that evening, they began drinking. That night would be the night that Constantine would initiate his girlfriend Ksenia, and once the group got Anya and Olya drunk enough, they lured them to the abandoned lot, where the rituals normally took place. They lined up so that they formed a pentagram, and in the center they lit a fire. Olya and Anya didn't really know what they were getting into at this point, but they just followed along. It isn't clear exactly who had come up with the plan, but when the signal was given, the Satanists lunged at the two girls. They dragged them to the ground, and several daggers were drawn. The cultists then stabbed both girls to death. Anton, also known as Dr. Goth, then took out a machete and beheaded both of them. Then the cultists took out their phones and began taking pictures of the girls' severed heads. Once they were satisfied with the pictures, they began dismembering the bodies. Limbs and organs were removed. They cut off the victims' scalps, breasts, and genitals, as well as removing their hearts and the tongues before cooking them and eating them. They collected their blood in the meantime, and Ksenia then smeared the blood on her face. During the initiation, she chose the nickname Kara, after they took the bodies and buried them in several pits along with a small rodent near the ritual clearing. Once the bodies were in the ground and covered, they all returned to Nikolai's apartment, and supposedly everyone passed out drunk. By the next day, June 29th, they had all decided to keep murdering. A young man named Andrei Sorokin had known the previous victims and the current Satanists, and he was friends with all of them. He traveled about an hour and a half from Rabinsk to hang out. A girl he had just started dating named Varya Kuzminya also joined him. The Satanist had always asked Andrei to join the cult, but he always refused. But he still enjoyed just socializing with them as friends. When he and his girlfriend arrived, he told the Satanist that some of the parents of the victims were looking for them. The Satanists were worried that Andrei would possibly tell the parents of the victims or the police about how Anya and Olya had been with the cult when they disappeared. Nikolai later called the couple, quote, unnecessary witnesses. So at some point, the group decided the couple would become their next victims. They all met at Nikolai's apartment as usual and began drinking. And then they headed over to the vacant lot. The plan was to murder them both, just like they did with Anya and Olya the night before. But at some point, Varya became uncomfortable and asked if they could leave. She could sense something was wrong. But the newly initiated Kara distracted her before they could go, and she began chatting her up and eventually convinced Varya to stay. When she calmed down the Satanist figure, they didn't have much time, so they attacked her and Andrei with knives. Andrei tried to fight back, but he was outnumbered, and the cultists stabbed him and Varya to death before dismembering them. As Nikolai stabbed Andrei, he shouted the number of blows out loud. One rumor spread that he ended up stabbing him 666 times while counting each stab wound as it happened. By now, Nikolai had officially been given the role of warrior in the group. Supposedly, he was the one who always initiated the killings, and he was the one to deliver the final blow by cutting the victims' throats. Alexei had been given the role of hellish secretary. He would take notes. Allegedly, he wrote the notes in a book that was bound in the skin of the victims. Anton, or Dr. Goth, was the organizer, and he had planned the get-togethers and the rituals. After the murders, they burned Andre's clothes in a ritual fire and buried the bodies near the lot. After this, they agreed to stop the murder rituals, at least for a while. They were worried that the police would catch on to what they were doing, and, as you're probably thinking, they were right. But it would take a few days for the victims' families and the police to notice what was actually going on. Even though four victims were now buried at the lot, some of the victims' parents weren't concerned yet. They thought their sons and daughters had actually gone off to the, quote, Invasion Music Festival. This is the largest open-air festival of Russian rock in the world, known as the Russian Woodstock. It was usually always held the first weekend in July. It was later canceled in 2020 and 2021 because of COVID-19, and in 2023 it was canceled because of the invasion of Ukraine. But in 2008, that would have been the ninth Invasion Festival with about 100,000 attendees. After the weekend was over, the victims' parents noticed that they never returned home. So in early July, their families had reached out to the police, and search parties began to form. And it didn't take long for the police to connect the missing victims to their Satanist friends. One of the victims, Varya, had called a friend before she was murdered. She had told her she was headed to Nikolai's apartment the night she went missing. So they picked up Nikolai in Rybinsk and took him in for questioning. He was the oldest in the group. For many, this also meant he was the most responsible for what had happened. After they brought him in, they also brought each of the suspected Satanists in as well. At first, they denied knowing each other. They had deleted their contact info from each other's phones, thinking they could outsmart the police. Then they also wrote text messages backward to each other. A series of interrogations lasted only a few days, and the founder, Constantine, was the first to crack, and he ended up showing police where they had committed the murders and where they buried the dismembered corpses. After the rest found out that Constantine had confessed, they all decided to confess too, including Nikolai. After realizing he was the only legal adult in the group, Nikolai's first thought was how he could get a shorter sentence.
So keep that in mind, that he's the only adult in this group, because that'll come into play during the sentencing and the trial. But as of now, only one of the original members, Anton, who aka Dr. Goth, hadn't been found by the police yet, but his friends ended up giving them his description, which was long black hair, he was covered in piercings, and he often wore black nail polish. And they gave officers his exact address, which was where they eventually found him. But when Anton answered the door, one of the officers described him as a, quote, an absolutely normal guy. He didn't look anything like how his friends had described him. He had cut his hair, changed his clothes, he didn't have on any nail polish, and at first they thought that they might have actually had the wrong guy. Then what's strange is that Anton wandered out into the street, and he then started acting strange and appeared to have some sort of mental break in front of the officers, like an episode of psychosis was going on or something, but officers weren't sure if he was just faking it or not. In the end, an ambulance then took him to the hospital for a short stint, where he was later diagnosed with schizophrenia. And although he appeared to be having some sort of break, the officers still took him in for questioning. And in the back of the police car, he was saying things like, quote, Satan is standing behind us. He will take revenge on you all. Satan is extending his hand to me. He acted strange until they got into the station, and then the officers claimed that he was just acting normal again. So I don't know what's going on here, but throughout a series of interrogations with Anton and the rest, the officers, they kind of had to win them over one by one and kind of become their friends to get any information out of them. They even had to start studying Satanism and reading some of the books and that material that we were talking about earlier, just to be able to kind of communicate to them on an even level here. Their investigation lasted for months. They had to piece together each relationship with each person and the communications between them all, which really wasn't that hard. They were just like, oh, you've been writing messages backwards. You're not as smart as you think you are. And they really had to understand who was responsible. That was the hard part here, because there were so many of them that they had to figure out, well, who was calling the shots? Was everyone in on this? Is this a grand conspiracy theory? So the investigation went on for some time, and the forensic work was also difficult. Since the victims' bodies were mutilated and dismembered, it was hard to tell which body part actually belonged to which victim. So they had to run countless DNA tests, which took a very long time. And since these tests took a long time, the families of the victims weren't even able to obtain the bodies for burials for several months, which is very unfortunate. But investigators also discovered there were more potential victims who were almost murdered by this Satanist cult. They had planned on killing another anonymous girl, but she managed to escape by offering her blood, which is pretty smart. Instead of killing her, she had somehow convinced them to just cut her hand with a blade and drink her blood. Then they released her and she never returned. Another victim might have been a young woman named Maria. She had previously dated one of the victims, if you remember, Andre. And at the time, he had introduced her to some of the concepts of Satanism. He was kind of interested in it because obviously all of his friends were interested in it, but he had never wanted to join the cult with his friends. Maria claimed that they dated for a long time. He was super sweet. He always got her nice gifts. He wrote her love poems and letters, but eventually it didn't work out. They broke up. Andre then started dating Varya, the other victim, right before they were both murdered. And one of the last times that Andre communicated with his ex-girlfriend Maria was through a strange message. He had said that he needed one of his gifts back that he had given her, and it was a small plaster dog. He claimed that the small figure connected them somehow. He recently had a premonition that he would die soon, and if Maria still had the dog, she would also die because of some supernatural connection through this dog figurine. So she ended up just giving it back to him. And Andre was unfortunately murdered a week later with his brand new girlfriend. He had messaged her one last time wishing her a good morning. And on that day, he was later murdered. So Maria thinks that, you know, if I was still dating him at the time, I would have shown up to that same party and she would have been another victim.
Wow. I really wonder how much he believed in this stuff.
Right. Yeah. It seems like, I don't know if it was a ploy just to see his ex-girlfriend again. Be like, hey.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've seen that before where it's like, it's like, oh, he still has my hoodie or something, you know, like yeah. It's just one last thing to, so you can
one more opportunity contact. To yeah. talk to them again. And
yeah. Or he actually believed there was some strange supernatural thing going on.
I feel like they did to some extent. Yeah. Feel like there was whatever they were doing. To go to this extreme to do what they did, I feel like one must believe in this beyond just like an interest level.
True. Yeah.
Right. Like, cause ultimately they believe they're, you know, in many of these different Satanists or devil worshiping sects believe they're doing these rituals and therefore getting power from the devil and, you know, getting closer to him and, you know, kind of gives them it's so bold what they did. I mean, to burn, you know, all bodies or bury bodies out in this field and burn, you know, clothing. And I mean, how did nobody see this going on?
Yeah. And that's why I think Andre had to have some idea of what was happening. And that's why they even said, you know, he kind of warned them like, hey, people are looking for those last two victims. So he must have connected the dots somehow and kind of known. It's strange that he would still willingly go to that vacant lot knowing
they were possibly there.
Murdering people there. Right. Yeah.
But by the start of the trials, the investigation had lasted well over a year, and the case materials had more than 35 volumes of evidence. The first closed hearing began on February 24, 2010, a year and a half after the murders took place, and their sentencing was held on July 26, 2010. Six of the accused walked into the courtroom. Anton, or Dr. Goth, Kofkin showed up wearing an unbuttoned shirt that exposed his chest, and he was also wearing makeup. He posed for the journalists in the courtroom and even snatched one of the journalists' microphone while the others hid their faces, including Nikolai. During the sentencing, the judge asked if any of them felt remorse, and you can probably guess what Dr. Goss said, but it was a simple no. The parents of the victims also stood in the courtroom and they had to listen in detail of how their children were brutally murdered and mutilated, cooked and then eaten by this group. According to Russian law, the punishment for a minor cannot exceed 10 years, regardless of the number of crimes or the brutality. That's insane.
Yeah, I'm all for being more lenient towards children, essentially, but that's wild. Regardless of the crime, it's 10 years max.
But remember, Nikolai, he was 18 at the time, and he was the only legal adult involved in the murders. So in the end, Nikolai was found guilty of two counts of murder committed by a group of persons by prior conspiracy, desecration of a burial, and desecration of a body, and he was sentenced to 20 years in maximum security prison. The founder, Konstantin Baranov, was found guilty of organizing the murders, murder committed by a group of persons by prior conspiracy, desecration of the bodies of the dead, and theft, and he, because he was a minor, was sentenced to 10 years. Alexei Solovyov and Alexei Chistikov were given 9 years for similar crimes. During Ksenia Kovalova's trial, her lawyers claimed that she had terminal cancer diagnosis. It's believed her defense exaggerated how severe it was to try and get a lighter sentence, and they even tried to get paperwork from her examinations published in the local newspapers. She ended up being sentenced to 8 years for the crimes. Sergei Karpenko, who did not directly participate in the murders, was sentenced to 2 years. As for Anton or Dr. Goth, Kofkin, he was sent to compulsory treatment in a psychiatric hospital.
And that's an indefinite sentence. It's basically like, if you can get better, you'll be released. So was he playing the game?
Right. Yeah. Or did he really have schizophrenia?
Yeah. And they also say, though, that sometimes it's kind of a crapshoot. This is as far as I researched into psychiatric hospitals or being sentenced to psychiatric hospitals in Russia, that sometimes you think you're getting a more lenient sentence because you can, hopefully you'll be like, oh, I'll get better and then I'll be released or something like that. But sometimes they're kept there for an even longer time period than
the actual sentence would be.
Yeah.
So it could potentially be more than 10 years.
Yeah.
So 10 years after the sentences were handed out, almost everyone was released. Cassinia was the first to leave, and her sentence was reduced from 8 to 6 years because it was confirmed that she had been diagnosed with leukemia. Some claim she died soon after her release, but her social media accounts were active for some time after. Alexei was released in 2017, and on his release, his girlfriend said she didn't believe he had committed the crimes, and they went on to live in St. Petersburg. He later claimed none of it was his fault, and he said that the officers who interrogated him pressured him into a confession. Anton, or Dr. Goth, avoided prison entirely. He went to a psychiatric hospital and was released after 1 year. He then disappeared from social media. The prosecutor is still confident he faked mental illness to avoid prison, and it was also discovered that he might have faked mental illness to avoid joining the military years before joining the Satanists. It's reported that he even faked a suicide attempt. Alexei Chistikov went back to live in Yaroslavl. And Konstantin, the founder of the cult, was released in 2020, and his whereabouts are unknown. While the rest were free, Nikolai spent several more years behind bars. He was sentenced to spend the majority of his time in a prison colony, similar to the old-fashioned gulags. Many are known to have harsh living conditions, if you know anything about gulags. But Nikolai was transferred to a safer colony at some point during his incarceration. And Nikolai spent most of his free time with woodworking. He carved small ships, backgammon boards, and decorative boxes. He also studied geometry and got a job as an assembler of plastic products. He soon became a foreman with his own team of assemblers while incarcerated. One of his old professors was shocked when Nikolai went to prison. They said, quote, "Those who knew him in college, the teachers, couldn't believe he had done this. He was quiet. For a long time, we didn't believe it was him." They also mentioned that they believed he had a troubled home life, which we don't know that much about. We couldn't find.
Unfortunately.
Because if we were to look at the home lives of all these kids, there's probably issues there.
Yeah, and I know like the father didn't live with them, which is strange, even before they later get divorced, but the father wasn't around at all, and then the mother would just take those vacations up to their second home, and so Nikolai was just left to his own devices.
Tons of freedom, yeah.
Yeah, so who knows what was going on.
But while he was in prison, he was visited often by his close family, and they always sent him letters and postcards. When he was transferred to a further prison colony, they stayed in touch by phone. By 2022, he still had about 7 to 8 more years left on his sentence, but he found a way to get out of prison early. Because the head of the Wagner Group, a Russian state-funded private military company, had just arrived at Nikolai's prison colony. He was looking for prisoners willing to participate in, quote, special operations in exchange for amnesty. After a few delays, Nikolai eventually signed his contract to fight, even though his mother begged him to stay in the prison colony. And even though he had poor eyesight, the Wagner Group still accepted him. At 33 years old, he was drafted into one of Russia's, quote, Storm Z battalions, and later given a full pardon by Vladimir Putin himself, despite the fact he's blind.
Yeah, he's blind. And
partially blind.
Yep. And a cannibal. Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
right.
Yet they're still letting this guy out. This is where the story really gets interesting, in my opinion. It blows my mind that they're so desperate for troops here that they're ready to hire anybody. So these battalions, they've been called penal battalions because many of them are made up by prisoners. And out of this desperation, Russia began recruiting its prisoners. And since the invasion of Ukraine, it's estimated that Russia has recruited somewhere around 100,000 people from its prisons.
Whoa.
Yeah. The Storm Z troops were assault troops meant to break through the most difficult areas in Ukraine. So
front lines,
basically cannon fodder here. The Kremlin later made a statement saying that, quote, "Those convicted of even the most serious crimes are atoning with blood for their crimes on the battlefields." This was obviously a controversial move, right? Local media outlets in Russia have reported serious offenses, including murder, by former prisoners after they were discharged from their military service.
Because that's the thing, is if they get wounded or discharged for any reason, it's not like they go back to the prison.
Yep. They're just released now. You're pardoned. Yep. And we'll see, this has happened to a lot of people, including Nikolai. It's also been reported that Russia has seen a rise in murder rates for the first time in nearly 2 decades. Now, This is especially near the Ukrainian border, and this could be due to many factors. You know, who knows? You can't really boil it down to one thing. It's a multifaceted issue here. But the Moscow Times reported that the increase in homicides, domestic and police violence, are both directly and indirectly related to the invasion of Ukraine. They also mentioned PTSD among soldiers as a factor, but these studies are still ongoing. This is still a developing thing, and this war is still happening as we speak. To make it even worse, you know, as we said, Nikolai was basically blind before he was recruited into the military. So they're basically just trying to
get anybody. They're not even like worried about that at all.
It's like, we're just going to send you to the front line. We need bodies on the field. But by November of 2023, so very recently, Nikolai was already back home with his family. He only spent April 15th to July 16th, 2023 in the military. So a very short amount of time. Nikolai, as we were just saying, was wounded in battle, and he's now disabled. He's walking again, but the wound was severe. According to Nikolai, this is what happened. He underwent 11 operations after his injury. It was reported that a fragment from a mine that had detonated went straight into his stomach, and he began first aid on himself out in the battlefield and was then dragged by four others, put on a stretcher, and carried 2.5 miles through mortar fire to an ambulance, where then he was taken to a hospital. Many, including himself, thought he would die from his injuries. I mean, usually if you get struck in the gut,
it seems like mortal wound there.
Yeah. In October, he had healed up by then. He was released from the hospital, given documents, paid an undisclosed amount of money, and he was released as a free man. If this isn't already concerning, Nikolai is not the only one who has had a tragically horrific history and has been released. There are many others. Another murderer, which I'll mention, I'll give the kind of the short story here. 27-year-old Vladislav Kanyas was also released from prison in the same fashion. He had spent 3 hours torturing and killing his former girlfriend, Vera Pektelova. Forensics reported 111 stab wounds to the victim. The neighbors even called emergency services 7 times, but no one came. In a recorded emergency phone call from a neighbor, Vera's screams were played in court. After stabbing her, he then choked her with an electrical cord of an iron and killed her. Her family and friends could not recognize her during the funeral. When he testified in court in 2022, he said, quote, "When I was hitting her, I did not like that she was screaming. I wanted her to shut up." This investigation lasted 22 months. He was found guilty and sentenced to 17 years and ordered to pay $45,000 to the family of the victim. But here we go. Less than a year later, he was sent to a Storm Z battalion in April 2023 and pardoned for his crime. He also no longer had to pay the $45,000 to the victim's family. Plus, in recent years, Russia has relaxed its prosecution and punishment on domestic violence crimes. So I'm not sure why that is, but Vera's friend Tanya Peskova told The Atlantic, quote, "I'm afraid of every noise now that she knows that this guy, Vladislav Kanyas, is just free." She's also worried that someone out there who doesn't know this guy's background might wind up in another relationship with him the same way that Vera did.
Are they not worried about these killers going out and just killing more?
Clearly not.
And the killers have no reason not to.
Yeah.
Like, oh, they'll just send me back out to fight more and
seriously,
I'll be released and come back. You know,
right.
It's like
the cycle continues. Yeah.
There's no actual punishment going on here. Really.
Exactly.
I mean, and justice for the victims in this particular
case. I was even reading that even people in Russia who are very pro, lenient on sentencing and rehabilitation and stuff like that, they're even saying that this is like extremely concerning.
Terrifying.
Yeah. By June 2023, it was reported that 32,000 of the recruited convicts had returned home as free men.
And we're not talking just like drug dealers or like nonviolent crimes. We're talking about
this is murderers.
Heinous killers.
Yeah. Murderers. Here we go. If this wasn't already extremely concerning, another serial killer, 44-year-old Denis Gorin, killed. He had 4 confirmed kills, possibly up to 13, but he was convicted for 4. And he was another cannibal, just like Nikolai. He ate 2 of his victims. He was also released not long after Nikolai. He was also injured and returned home. Even though he was originally sentenced to 22 years, he only served 5, then had a short military sentence, was then freed because he was injured. Now he's just back on the streets. One of his neighbors said, quote, this is where it gets really interesting. Yeah. The neighbor said, quote, I don't think he'll be free for long. His victims' relatives all remember him. So I'm curious if we'll see some like vigilante justice going down over there, because this is out of control. Several horrific crimes have been committed by these convicts since their return, including the murder of an 85-year-old woman and the rape of 2 young girls. But only the most brutal crimes have been reported and prosecuted. And in response, Putin admitted last June in 2023, quote, indeed, there is recidivism, but then the person must be held accountable to the full extent of the law, no matter what. Since then, he has continued to pardon killers so long as they fight in Ukraine. Yeah, that's just a lot.
I'd be terrified.
Yeah.
If I lived in Russia right now.
And I mean, Putin saying must be held accountable to the full extent of the law. Well, we're seeing the extent of the law here.
The law is releasing them back into society after they go fight.
Right. Yeah. Totally disgusting.
In December 2023, Nikolai sat down with an interviewer from the Russian publication 76RU. Nikolai enjoyed eating a strudel while explaining that the first thing he did as a free man was go to a hockey game with his family. When asked about the crimes, he said, quote, the past remains in the past, but he also admitted that after spending time in prison, he regretted his mistakes. He asked for forgiveness and said that his actions were the biggest mistakes of his life. He said, quote, once again, I sincerely apologize to the relatives of the victims for committing such a stupid act in my youth. I sincerely regret this and repent. Of course, I think this most likely cannot be forgiven. After his release from the military group, he returned to live with his mother in Yaroslavl. His parents had divorced soon after his imprisonment, and he has since tried to find consistent work, but struggles with physical labor because of the injuries and his poor vision. He has admitted he has no friends now and spends most of his time with his family, especially his parents, who are the only ones who defend him. Since Nikolai's conviction, some of his other family members, including his brother, don't talk to him. He once told Nikolai, quote, my wife doesn't want to communicate with criminals. Now Nikolai dreams of finding a wife of his own and having children. He also thinks he'll make for a good father. He said, quote, my parents tried their best. I thank them very much. They provided me with everything. Now I am obliged to provide them with grandchildren. As for the victims' families, Nikolai claimed he asked them for forgiveness in court, but he has not tried to contact them since his release. According to him, he has received death threats from the victims' family members, but in response he said, quote, I can understand them, maybe they said it all out of emotion, but still, God protects those who are careful. Man, that is, I just don't like anything he's saying.
I know, pretty rich coming from a former Satanist who's also a cannibal talking about God. I'm not sure.
He just acts like he can just like wash himself clean of everything that he did.
Yeah.
And he's not, you know, he's saying things to publicly that, you know, make him seem like he's this reformed guy.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, you know, the family members of the victims are, you know, still, I mean, they probably want him dead at this point.
Sure.
I mean,
or
back in prison at the very least.
Yeah.
Just can't even imagine how you would deal with that. That stress and anxiety, knowing that your loved one's killer is just living their life with no restrictions, mind you.
Yeah. Free man. Completely free.
Going to hockey games with his family, talking about how he's going to start a family now. It's just so messed up.
Thinks he's going to be a good father. Yeah, right.
Yeah. Okay, dude. He believes that if he just kept up with his sailing hobby and never gotten into Satanism, then all this would have never happened. Apparently, now he has gained faith in God, goes to church, and wears an Orthodox cross around his neck. When asked if God would forgive him, he said, quote, the Lord forgives everyone. Maybe he does.
Yep. I don't know. I can't speak for the Lord, but in this case, I mean, it's like you didn't spend enough time for your crimes, buddy.
Yeah. you're still living here, buddy. Like, yeah, you still got to pay for what you did. As of 2020, Elena, the mother of one of the victims, Anya, says that she still has not forgiven any of the perpetrators, even when they personally asked for her forgiveness. She said, quote, "I live in the memory of my daughter. She is with me in my heart. May this never happen again. I wish parents to live longer than their children, to be aware of their interests, to simply take care of them. I didn't save Anya." It's heartbreaking.
That is heartbreaking.
Just the whole thing's just a complete tragedy. And
yeah. And I sense a bit of guilt there. She's like, to be aware of all their interests, you know,
yeah,
because maybe she felt that she wasn't monitoring her daughter enough or something. But she couldn't have predicted something like this would happen.
Yeah. I mean, just because it's, you know, depending on your belief systems and what you think, you know, you might look at, if you're an Orthodox Christian, you might look at somebody who's into the goth culture or even, you know, Satanism or some of the darker stuff out there, that, you know, they're going down a bad road, and, you know, what can you really do?
Yeah.
You know, rebellion's a real thing, especially in 17, 18 years old. So
for sure. I mean, did you, when you were in high school, were there like the goth kids?
Oh yeah.
I don't know how prevalent they are. Are there goth kids still around in high school?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's still a subculture.
Yeah.
Has it? Okay. Yeah. And they were harmless though.
Yeah.
Not like they were.
It's just expressing yourself. I mean,
yeah,
it's easy to judge and be like, oh, they're evil. Why? Cause they wear black and,
right,
you know, have certain imagery on their shirts or whatever. Like, yeah, it's just a way to express yourself. It's like, is everybody who listens to heavy metal a bad person? Or
I hope not.
You know,
I listen to heavy metal.
Yeah, so it's like,
I mean, I was a goth kid in high school. And
were you really?
Yeah, and I never wanted to eat people.
Come on, we need to see the pictures.
Oh no, no, though they are hidden and gone.
I'm gonna ask Anna Lee.
Destroyed all the evidence.
I'm gonna find those pictures.
Well, it's like, you know, I think we all like participated in the emo culture too, to some extent. You know, like that was a big thing. And
yeah, I'm from the Midwest. Midwest emo is a big,
that's right,
big thing there. Yeah,
it's like whatever. It's just, you know, you're trying to figure yourself out as a teenager and you're expressing yourself in different ways, and it's like who you associate with too.
Yeah,
you oftentimes, you know, would change your appearance to fit in with a certain group of people or, you know, feel accepted. And so it's a very normal thing. It's just, it's like, how do you know when they're taking it to the level of literally murdering people?
Right.
It's just, yeah, it's wild that it got to that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I think alcohol probably played a huge part in the violence escalating, right? Like if you're getting raging drunk and there's knives and blood and, you know, you're worshiping the devil.
Yeah.
I mean,
and we've talked about this before where we, helicopter parenting is concerning and we wouldn't want to be like that. You know, I wouldn't want to be like that if I had kids, but a part of me thinks it's like, oh, where is my son or daughter? They're just going to this guy's apartment and getting hammered on the weekends or whatever. I mean, it's not necessarily a red flag because I think you're 17 years old. That's when those things start happening more often. So it wouldn't necessarily be a concern to be like, oh, they're going to murder somebody. But I think with the culture, with having this friend group that is descending into this ideology that seems to be maybe spearheaded by Constantine, and he's reading these books, and even Nikolai admitted, he's like, I didn't really understand what we were getting to, but we were still following this guy. So I think that like slow descent with the alcohol, with the unmonitored activity, kind of all of it just ended up escalating.
I mean, I can only imagine they were just consuming excessive amounts of alcohol to get to the point where you're not only murdering somebody, but dismembering them and then eating them.
Right.
I mean, that is just like,
in a conspiracy too. There's multiple people there. Yeah. So that would, yeah.
It's honestly mind blowing to think that it got to that point.
Right.
And they're this young too.
Right.
And I mean, it's not unheard of by any means, but I just wonder who really,
you know, was behind it, calling the whole shots.
Thing. Right.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of seems like it was at least, you know, Nikolai was definitely probably the most influential person in the group. But then Dr. Goth.
Yeah. You know, which, can we talk about that name?
Yeah, Dr. Goth.
Okay. Stupid name. I know it's translated from, you know, Russian, but what a weird name. I think that was his, like, when he was initiated, that was his, like, initiation name, because they all got to choose their own. But yeah, I think also back to the who's responsible, it's easy to point out Nikolai, and I think you should point him out because he was the oldest one of the bunch. He was the one buying the liquor. He was the one offering his apartment for people to crash there. So I think even if he wasn't actively planning it, I mean, he was also the enforcer, and we know that witnesses were saying, like, he was the one that was slitting the throats for the final coup de grace and things like that. So, and also just by nature of him being older, I think usually, I mean, when you're that age, I remember being a freshman in high school thinking that the seniors in high school were like adults.
Yeah.
Right.
Totally.
Like, that age gap was so huge back then. So even if they're just a little bit older, you have so much respect for them
totally.
At that age.
That's a
good
point.
So I think just by nature of him being older, he's definitely more responsible.
I feel like the extremeness to the crimes was a way to control the rest of the group too, like to show just how powerful they were and how, you know, how much influence they had over them. And it's a way to blackmail all of them.
True.
You know,
yeah.
You're now a part of these
all
heinous
of it.
Crimes.
Yeah.
So you can't, you know, oust us.
That's a good point. Yeah. Everyone was
even
involved.
They pretty much did in the end. But I think, yeah, just like the crimes are just so heinous. I just don't understand, unless one of them, you know, I think mental illness could have definitely played a role in this and could have led to things getting as extreme as it did. Because it's just hard to really say how much they really believed in this, you know, devil worshiping and sect of Satanism they were reading into.
And that's the big mystery too. We don't have the materials that they
were reading. We don't know exactly what they were looking at.
Yeah, I'm sure they're in somewhere in that like 35 volume evidence stack somewhere. But yeah, unfortunately that wasn't available to us. So we're not really sure what they were reading, what was influencing them to some degree.
But it's a damn shame that they're all
of them are free.
They're all free now. None of them are doing their time. I was honestly surprised to find that they just execute them for these types of crimes.
Yeah.
And I get they're minors, but I don't know.
Yeah.
I didn't know that Russia almost seems a bit more lax on their sentencing than here in the United States. I mean, we've covered a number of teen killers who get, you know, life in prison. Some even almost face death in certain cases. So
they do have the harsher penal colonies though, where
they'll
put you to these hard, like you go to work and stuff. And
that's very true.
Yeah. It's like these terrible conditions in some of the penal colonies. So I think that's the trade-off where it's like, yeah, you're only getting 20 years,
but it's in
a big chunk of that is, yeah, exactly. You're basically in hell.
But yeah, this one is shocking and disturbing and sad at the end of the day.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what those families deal with every day, knowing that they're out there and all the victims of these killers that have been released. I mean, that's a terrifying place to be, knowing in the back of your head they could, I mean, retribution. On, you know, what if you spoke out against one of these killers in court or something like that?
Right. Yeah.
And now this killer's literally roaming free, seemingly no restrictions.
Yep. That's why even Nikolai, where he was like, yeah, I've gotten death threats, but also it's kind of rational. Like he, even he gets it. So that says a lot. I think that speaks volumes that even the murderer who is convicted is saying, like, I kind of expected death threats because I think the reading between the lines there is that he's even admitting that there's some problem here. Even if he doesn't like say it outright, he's accepting that the death threats seem normal because the situation's so crazy.
At least it seems like he has some understanding of what he did.
Yeah.
Maybe some remorse for what he did. I think the comment about doing stupid things in your youth, I think that kind of holds true. Although I think that's still a bit insensitive considering all things, considering it wasn't just like you were being stupid as a kid. You were
malicious. This is something
evil.
Way worse
evil.
Than just being stupid.
Thank you. Evil is the word. You were being evil.
A DUI is stupid.
Yeah,
right. But slitting people's throats is
and
just
consuming them is evil.
Like, yeah.
That's not a stupid childish mistake.
I don't like how he's downplaying the severity of his crimes.
No. Yeah, agreed.
When they are the most brutal things 100%. You could do to another human being.
100%.
And yeah, I don't know. I don't buy any of his shit. I think he's full of it. And I think the, you know, I found God, I'm changed, you know, I'm forgiven. Good for you that you think that, but everybody else doesn't agree with that.
Yeah. And even if God forgives you, maybe you should just spend some more time in prison. God will still forgive you in there, but maybe you should head back.
Yeah. Terrifying though. But we want to know your thoughts on this one. Again, this, you know, we don't normally kind of go outside of, you know, more of the English speaking countries for the very reason it's just very difficult to research these cases and really get like all the details and get the backstories. And it's very, very difficult to do it. So I kind of went out on a limb on this one. But I think it's still definitely a case that people should know about. But
yeah, and let us know if you like the international cases. I don't mind researching them. They're sometimes a little bit harder, but I think some of these stories need to be told, because
definitely
I don't think anyone's really covered this story, and at least English speakers haven't really gone into detail on this. So yeah, let us know if you enjoy these international stories a little bit more.
Definitely. But that's where we're gonna wrap up today. We'll catch you guys next week with another one, and until then, lights out, everybody.